Dear listeners, before we begin the episode, I'm going to be rude and ask you for money. I guess this is especially meant for Dutch listeners, but if you happen to be an international billionaire, well, I'm grateful for your contribution too. This podcast is a labor of love, and if you didn't know, podcast making can be quite expensive. Therefore, we are super happy with our Patreon sponsors, and we need more of you. Visit patreon.com/ziekdepodcast to donate to our show if you're interested. Thanks a lot. Dear listeners, welcome to Ziek the Podcast. My name is Tamer Doorduin and I am your host, taking you with me to the land of the sick and the ill, or as I would say in my native tongue, Dutch, to the Lappenmand, which literally translates to rag basket. I live in the Netherlands and this podcast is usually in Dutch, but for this miniseries I make an exception as I interviewed Swedish patient advocate and activist Sarah Riegere. If you haven't yet listened to the first episode in this series, it's probably a good idea to go back first so that you know the background story of how Sarah got sick and what kind of hashtag doctor drama she experienced. However, if you're not very patient and you just want to dive into what Sarah has got to say about her patient advocacy nowadays, I won't blame you either, and I think you will still find the current episode very interesting. So, in the first episode of the series, Sarah talked about how she had her first symptoms when she was 13 and how she initially got the diagnosis dystonia, but eventually learned, quite by accident, that she actually had juvenile Parkinson's disease, which is a rare form of Parkinson's. We start the second part of the interview where we left off, which is with the fact that Sarah felt that the Dystonia Association, where she was an active member, was no longer her rightful place to be a patient advocate. Instead, she joined the Parkinson's Association. However, this was actually kind of a culture shock to her.
Change teams in a way, and also entering a space where there were so many more older people because of the dystonia wasn't as strictly older population as Parkinson's. So that was a bit interesting as well.
How did you feel about it?
I was in my 20s. It wasn't the most fun thing I've done. I can confess that. To go to sort of these information meetings at elderly living facilities, it wasn't ideal. But there you go. I learned a lot from it. Mm-hmm. But then a couple of years in, I was contacted by a person in Stockholm who wanted to start a local branch for younger people with Parkinson's.
Ah, cool.
People younger than, I think we started at 50 or younger than 50 or... But I think we later expanded it to younger than 65, so people in working age with Parkinson's. It's not really a youth organization, but it's still younger people with Parkinson's are sort of, So
it's relative.
It is relative, and that really was where it started. And we started having these, we met at the pub once every month, and we had sort of an open invitation. So anyone, just like, come meet us, we will be here between 6 and 8 or something, and people came and had a beer and had a chat and exchanged experiences, and some people came only once and then never came back, and some people came regularly, and it became a network. And we also organized more formal conferences and similar things along these lines as well.
Maar Sarah die wilde op een andere manier zich gaan inzetten.
And then I don't remember specifically, but I started exploring things, and I also wanted to do more. So I realized that I wanted to help researchers understand. I wanted to help patients understand research and vice versa.
Yeah.
So with my engineering background, I have a master's in chemical engineering. And I could sort of get by. I could already then read the scientific articles and understand them, so at least. Mm-hmm. I could sort of get through them and understand the main points.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do that in a more organized way. So I wanted to be. Have you read the book series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
No, I haven't.
Anyway, so they talk about the Babel fish, which is an alien. It's an alien fish that you put in your ear that translates every language to every other language.
You wanted to make that.
It was like a Google Translate, but earlier. And I wanted to be a Babel fish for Parkinson's, between patients and researchers.
Yeah, that's so important.
Yeah, and I realized that to be taken seriously by researchers, you have to be a researcher yourself.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, so I was sort of, And then my husband said, but why don't you become a researcher? No, I can't do that. And then I thought, maybe I can.
Yeah, wow.
And then this was in 2010, and I looked at, so living in Stockholm, the Karolinska Institute is it's local, it's from here.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured that, well, I could check their website, because everybody had a website anyway in 2010. And I found a master's program in health informatics that started that you could apply for, and they started that August in 2010, and this was sort of the last week or so to apply for the program.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and I was accepted.
Very impulsive. But what I don't understand is, why did you have to be taken seriously by researchers? Because you basically wanted to translate the research to patients.
Yeah, but I also wanted to translate the other way around. So I wanted to translate from patients to researchers. So I wanted to be the spokesperson both ways.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
And so what I figured out was I needed research. Then I had to go into doing a doctorate, and I don't think I thought that far at that point. But I sort of thought I need to get to know people in medicine. So that's when I went to try and network at Karolinska Institute. So that's where it started. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, was it a good master?
Oh yeah, I mean it was. We were 46 students from 13 different countries on the first day.
Oh, cool.
Ages from 22 to 46.
So you weren't the only one who was doing a career shift.
No, I wasn't. No. So it was very interesting. I usually describe it as every day felt like in a UN convention, because. People literally from all over the world.
So you all needed to be Babel fishes.
We needed to be Babel fishes. And half of us had a medical background, and half of us had a technical background.
Ah, and were there more people like you who were patient advocates?
There was actually a woman from Iraq. She was born in the US, but with Iraqi descent. And she has MS.
Ah, yeah.
So she started the same program as me, and we had a lot of interesting discussions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was the first year of that master's program, and actually every year since, there's been one or a few patients who have entered the program to sort of enter the field of health informatics.
Yeah. So what do you learn as a health, like... What did you learn in the master?
Health informatician, yeah.
Yeah.
So health informatics is basically the research and theories behind e-health.
Ah.
So it's all use of information and communication technology in health and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So everything from online health records to patient portals to medical databases to programming to apps to... Basically everything you can think of using information and communication and technology in health and healthcare.
Yeah, using it online or through technology, not the face-to-face communication.
Yes, but also sort of very theoretical clinical decision support systems or artificial intelligence algorithms. So it's a very wide field, actually.
Yeah.
So, and then there's subsets of subfields, of course, and I'm very much focused on the field of personal health informatics or consumer health informatics.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's nursing health informatics, medical health informatics. There's all sorts of health informatics, but it's a wide field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and well, I got to know you because of this word spetspatient that you came up with. Was that already in that period or like?
No, spetspatient is a word that I made up or came to coin in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yeah.
So I started the health informatics master's program in 2010. In 2012, I started my doctoral studies.
Ah, yeah.
I'm a doctoral student at the Department for Learning, Informatics, Management, and Ethics at the Karolinska Institute.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And so
you did do it.
Yeah. So, and during that period, and then in 2016, I've always been sort of a patient advocate, patient activist.
Yeah.
Also in my research. So the word, I've always been a bit envious of the US word e-patient,
mm-hmm.
which was invented or coined in the 2007, around that time, by a doctor in the US called Tom Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
So I've tried to sort of use e-patient in Swedish, but it sort of hasn't worked. No one has sort of taken it up or used it.
Yeah.
And then in the UK they have e-patient, but they also use expert patient as an expansion.
Yeah.
And that hasn't worked either in Swedish or in Sweden. I've tried as well. So this was sort of my third attempt of having a word for something that me and so many other patients do every day.
Yeah.
And since we haven't had a word for it in Swedish before, it sort of hasn't. You can't talk about it if you don't have a word for it.
No, exactly.
So if you have to say a whole sentence, people get tired from talking about it. So I was frustrated. In 2016, I was frustrated again by the how healthcare, and specifically in some doctors, view patients as needy and always and that they say don't Google your symptoms, never Google your patients. And this was the word spetspatient was a counter reaction to that frustration. Yeah.
How would you explain the word spetspatient for people outside of Sweden?
Yeah, so if they're American and know what an e-patient is, I would say it's a Swedish word for e-patient.
Uh-huh. Dutch people don't know it.
So people don't know it. It started out as so there's this, in the area of research about design and technology, there's a word called lead user, which is people who experience a need that you can expect a larger group of people to experience later, but these people experience that need sooner.
Yeah.
And they also act on that need, and they do something about it. So for example, the area of mountain biking started in the 1970s in California.
Mm-hmm.
By people who is biking enthusiasts who used ordinary bikes and rode them in on forest or mountain tracks, and because they thought it was fun to ride their bikes in the mountains or on mm-hmm. in the forest. And then some of them, specifically one man who had an education as a bike constructor, bike frame constructor, he adapted his bike so it made it more sturdy with a more durable frame and better tires, and that was the start of a whole industry in biking, the mountain bike.
Yeah.
So he and these early users that used and adapted their bikes, they're called lead users.
So it's because of their circumstances
They have an interest or a need, and they also have the ability to do something about it.
Yeah, so both things.
Yeah, yeah.
They have a need and they have strategies to get that need met.
So, or opportunities or just ideas, and they find ways to do something about it.
Yeah.
Another example is people who wanted to video record their skiing.
Ah.
So they used tape and scotch tape their mobile phones to their skiing helmets.
Ah, yeah.
And then they started thinking maybe we should make a separate camera, and the GoPro came out of that idea. So the GoPro industry, the sort of action cameras. Is an expansion of that. And these people are called lead users, these people who start and try and test new things.
Mm-hmm.
And in Swedish, the word for lead user is spetsanvändare.
Yeah.
And then I just exchanged användare, which is user, to patient, which is patient. And then we have spetspatient.
And it worked.
Mm-hmm. It worked. Yeah, it did.
So can you give an analogous example of a spetspatient, like that does the same as the mountain biker and the skier?
Yeah, sure. For instance, in diabetes, the industry, so the medical industry, the medical device industry, have been talking about looping and sort of making a loop of the treatment. So connecting continuous glucose monitor with the insulin pump and making algorithms do the calculations and sort of automate the treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And the medical device industry and the medical industry have been talking about this for literally decades. And patients have been waiting and waiting and waiting for these.
Yeah.
So in a couple of years ago, a woman called Dana Lewis, who has had diabetes since she was a child, type 1 diabetes, she met a man who she's now married to him, but he helped her program a very small Raspberry Pi mini computer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's small enough to carry around. It's like a matchbox.
Oh, wow, that's super small.
Very small. It's very small.
Yeah.
So, and it has a sort of circuit, and you can do simple programming on it. So they used Bluetooth connectors to her glucose meat monitor and her insulin pump, and they made a loop. And it turns out that the problem wasn't technical. The problem was basically about, it was a business problem.
Ah, because they could just do it. They wanted it and they made it work.
The two devices were made from different companies and they couldn't agree on who would get paid for what. So that's why they haven't done it. So Dana is very much a spetspatient, and they made this device and they share the plans. They don't sell it. It's not a product. And that means that no one, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, they can't, they have no oversight of it because it's not a product. They're not, no one is paying anyone to get this device. They build their own and they help each other. And they share the algorithms on GitHub, open access. So Dana is definitely a spetspatient, and I know her. I met her at conferences, and we And another person is a UK man who's called Michael Sears.
Mm-hmm.
He's had Crohn's disease since he was a child. He's now 49, 50 something. And he had a bowel transplant in the UK. He was the 11th person in the UK to undergo a complete bowel transplant, or a small bowel transplant, I think he had.
So that's something that doesn't happen yet very often.
No, this is a couple of years ago though. But
yeah.
So, and then he had a bad case of Crohn's disease. And he was given a stoma bag then because he to take care of the waste. And mm-hmm. then he was in his hospital bed and sort of recovering from the major surgery. And then he had, as he calls it, his first oh shit moment when the bag leaks.
Oh.
And it's not it's not if, it's when, he tells me. And so he figured, okay, I'll just go online. Because of course some smart and clever American has made a sensor to tell how full a stoma bag is. So I'll just order that and this will be sorted.
So you need to know that. So that's the problem, that it leaks when it's too full. So you need to check it the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
And when he was in the hospital and he was like still knocked out from the...
Yeah, he had, so he wanted to order it, but there wasn't such a device.
It didn't exist.
No. And he had no background in design and no background in technology, but he figured, okay, I have a problem. I need to solve this.
Yeah.
So he disassembled a control for a computer game that has sort of a bending sensor. Mm-hmm. So he could use it to tell how full the bag was.
Ah.
So he constructed this device, and he has the world patent for it, and he now is the CEO of the company selling these devices.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so he's also a Spetspatient, as you can imagine.
Yes. Okay, so how did you... how am I going to phrase this question? Like, what in your development made that you thought it was so important to talk about this, about Spetspatienter?
Because I want healthcare and patients to change their attitudes about patients. Because patient is a word derived from, I think, Greek or Latin, not sure now, but it means the one who suffers.
Ah.
And in the old days, of course, there was a lot of suffering in being a patient. There wasn't a lot you could do if you had a disease or an injury or an illness.
Mm-hmm.
So basically there was a lot of suffering. But now with the development and all the new medication, all treatments available to us, there's a much less suffering. But the word still means the one who suffers. So I wanted to sort of reclaim and enhance the word a bit and make it something more positive. Because being a patient is a very passive and negative and a very... a negative word. I wanted to give it a positive spin.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, because when I heard about this word and I tried to like understand what it meant, what it made me, how I interpreted it was mostly that there's just this idea that patients who want to find out things about their illness or like who look up the research, who take research studies to their doctors.
Mm.
It's often perceived as a problem. Like it's a problem if as a patient you look up stuff on the internet.
Yes.
And I can kind of understand that it can be a problem if somebody does that, because there's also a lot of crap on the internet. So you have to find the right sites. But like, even like I have worked as a researcher, not as a medical researcher, as a sociologist and like sexology. So it's very different. But like I've worked as a researcher, and even I encounter this, that when I tell doctors this, like, okay, I know where to look for information, it's still... It's still like they have a hard time with it.
Right.
Hmm?
They think it's a bit suspicious.
Yes, they think it's suspicious. So is that something that you also experienced with your...
Yes. I still do sometimes.
Yeah. So can you tell me about this?
Yeah. So I tend to behave, I call it being doctor-centric. Know how you talk about that healthcare should be patient-centered and patient-centric. But I'm doctor-centric, doctor-centered. Because I when I meet a new doctor, a new physician, a new healthcare professional, I know I can't tell from just looking at them if they are of a kind that can, that like engaged patients or if they are negative towards it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very, very careful and cautious initially and sort of not don't show I don't show them how much I know. I'm very sort of I don't tell them my theories. I let them suggest and then I sort of try and see what kind they are before I show my true self.
Yeah.
So I adapt to what I think they want to hear.
Were there times that you didn't do that and it went wrong?
Yes.
Can you tell me about it?
So sometimes I went to, I think it was a new primary care physician that I hadn't seen before. And I said, I think I have a urinary tract infection.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, no, why would you think that? No. And they refused me actually to have a test.
Uh-huh.
Because they wanted to assert themselves as knowing more. So they felt threatened by my presentation of theories.
Yeah. So like, did they still ask you questions about your complaints? And like do a decent doctor, like how do you say that? Medical interview?
Yeah, they did, but they don't have a lot of time. So they basically said, come back if it doesn't improve and sent me off on my way.
And what do you think would have happened if you wouldn't have presented this theory?
There's no way of knowing, of course. I could have been treated exactly the same. But I think that if I would have been with this person, if I would have been less assertive and sort of just presented my symptoms and they would have been able to say, well, go take this test. This is just speculation on my part, but it could be that they would have treated me differently.
Yeah, yeah. I always find it so difficult to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's difficult. It is difficult.
Because it's also a gamble. Like, if you just present your symptoms, like, you kind of assume that they would reach the same conclusions. But what if they don't?
And you hope that they would ask the right questions.
Yes.
They actually don't always.
No.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. So why do you think that the doctors are this way?
I think they're trained that way. I think the system is adapted for... So, the medical system is built on the assumption that the doctor always knows best.
Yeah.
But now with the internet and everything, we all basically have access to all the world's knowledge at our fingertips.
Yeah.
But it's not always... And the number of diseases and the number of complaints, so the science is developing and it's not possible for one person to know everything.
Yeah.
So it's not unusual for patients to actually know more, especially if they have a chronic or long-term condition. And this doctor maybe is not an expert in specifically that condition. And maybe that has implications on the treatment.
Yeah, because that's also the thing that, of course, it's not that you know more than your doctor. It's just that about a certain specific illness that you have, you have looked up the latest research and that doctor, like, is responsible for a lot of different illnesses.
Exactly, yeah.
And is seeing and treating patients the whole day.
Yeah.
And maybe has less time than you have to look up the latest research.
And also doesn't know my context, which could have implications on the treatment as well.
Yeah.
So it's I think the doctors who are still not perceptive for the idea of e-patients or spetspatienter are too immersed and too ingrained in the old thinking of the paternalistic system and the doctor knows best kind of thing.
Is it a cultural thing?
I think so to some extent, but I don't know exactly because I haven't really been in healthcare as a patient in other countries than Sweden.
Yeah, no, I mean like I more mean like the medical world as a subculture.
Oh yes, oh it's definitely subculture. Oh yes, very much so. It's very much a hierarchical and different structure than the rest of the society.
So how come that? Because you know it's kind of like as the world becomes more modern or has become more modern, a lot of how do you say that aspects of society have become less hierarchical. But it seems, yeah. So why do you think that is? Have you any theories about that?
So interestingly, we have a Dutch man as the CEO of the Swede of the Karolinska Hospital in Stockholm.
Oh, that's right. I think I heard about that.
He used to be the CEO of
Radboud. Yeah.
And he actually said that he thought that Sweden and Netherlands would be similar in their structure in terms of the medical culture, since they're so similar in societal culture.
Mm-hmm.
But that Swedish healthcare is so much more hierarchical than the Dutch one. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Still more.
And I think, I mean, he knows because he's been in both. And
yeah, definitely.
I which actually... Yeah, it surprised me a bit, but maybe not. Well, I don't doubt it. I think he's right. But it's interesting because there's also sort of national cultural aspects to it as well, I think. But I think that healthcare has this hierarchy because so far it has needed it to organize itself properly. But it now, because of their quick decisions need to be made in critical situations and people need to know what their job is. And then it's like a military action, really, in some sense, in the emergency care.
Yeah, that's right. Because like a lot of medicine is, of course, also about life and death.
Yes, and medicine.
I always forget that.
because that's the way it developed. So the triage system that is used in medical care and emergency care was developed in a war medical as a, the medicine as a area came out of wars.
Oh, and that's right. Like the military is also super hierarchical.
Exactly. So that's where I think the heritage comes from.
Yeah.
But then we know that so acute care has to be organized in one way, but to manage chronic and long-term conditions, you have to organize very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that adaptation hasn't been reached in healthcare to any kind of extent, I would say.
Yeah.
Because it takes a major reorganization to reach the new kind of the organization needed for chronic care.
Yeah, also because you can change the structure or you can like have some idea, okay, let's do this and this different.
Yeah.
But to change the whole culture.
Exactly.
That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always also forget that in large part, the medical system is about life and death because my illness is not about life and death.
Yeah.
And I just always forget that that's there too.
Yeah. And that's easy to organize. I mean, easy in quotation marks, but that's where you need hierarchy. You need checklists. You have sort of one set of rules that works when you're going to resuscitate and you're going to do life support.
Yeah,
but chronic illness is a different thing because that. So in emergency care, when you need to save someone's life, you don't need to ask them how much they want to participate themselves. You just do things to save their life.
Yeah, because otherwise you're too late.
Yeah, but in chronic care, you need to collaborate in a completely different way. Because in chronic care, most chronic illnesses, I would say all of them, you don't have one size fits all in treatment. You have to collaborate, physician and medical personnel and patient, to find the best ideal treatment. And you can't do that as a one size fits all.
Yeah. Yeah, there's also much more opportunity to really optimize the treatment. And it's also more important because it's chronic.
Exactly.
It's like if you have an illness for a few months,
yeah,
it's not so important if your quality of life is optimized. But if, like you, you have it like for more longer than you have had it longer than you didn't have it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Then it matters so much.
Yes. And there's so much I can do. And basically yeah. I'm the one who has most to gain for putting in the work. And then I'm willing to do that because I have so much to gain from it.
Yeah, exactly. And also it works better. It's more efficient if you and your doctor really work together.
Yeah.
Because you have so much more information and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but that's so interesting. There should actually like be a whole new system for chronic patients.
Sadly enough, there is a suggestion, and it was published 20 years ago in research.
Mm-hmm.
But it still hasn't been adopted in healthcare because it was probably too... It has in part. Mm-hmm. But there was something called the chronic care model published in 1998.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's a really good sort of overview of what it should be like, a system for chronic care.
Mm-hmm. And as it takes 20 years for things to be picked up.
But it seems like organizational changes takes even longer.
Yeah, I can imagine. Has it been picked up at all? As you know,
there are pockets, but the problem is then those pockets and those implementations are in specific diagnoses or conditions,
yeah.
And since more and more people also have multiple conditions,
is it like, because in the Netherlands, I know that they're like, if you have diabetes or asthma or certain heart diseases, I know that there's a whole new system for that.
Yes, that's where those are some conditions that this model has been implemented more successfully. Yeah.
Yeah, like that you mostly go to your GP or like a special person. And
yeah, you have a network in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm always so jealous about that.
Yeah, I tend to say that I have diabetes envy because they have
yes.
a very of course I understand that's a huge,
it's ridiculous, of course, but
huge simplification.
Yeah.
But they have a measure of their blood glucose level that they can use to optimize, and they also have the long-term measure of HbA1c that
yeah.
they can use. As to communicate with their healthcare professionals as well.
Yeah, so that they are not so dependent on subjective.
Exactly, because in neurological diseases and also psychological and mental health, there's very few objective measures, and it's a lot about perception, and it's difficult to sort of have a useful discussion with healthcare if you don't have a joint measure to talk about.
Yeah. We have covered most of your history,
mm-hmm.
but just the last years are a bit murky now. So is there anything that you can like fill in about the last years? Or like, are there any special moments there, like for example, that you came up with this word spetspatient, or that you started your doctorate, or something else that is important to tell us?
So I attended my first quantified self conference in 2011 or 11 actually.
Mm-hmm.
And quantified self is a community for self trackers.
Ah, yeah.
And that I didn't know that there was a word to describe what I've been doing, sort of evaluating and measuring, not measuring as such objective measures, but sort of observing and evaluating, like I do as an engineer. And I didn't know there was a word for it, but I've always done it, sort of observing and noting on in my calendar and seeing, okay, so today this medication at this time gave me this effect. So what happens if I do it? If I change the time, or what happens if I do this? And so I've made these notes and done these for years and years. And so that conference and that community has really become very, very important to me. And I've been learning so much from that community. And most of the people at those conferences are not patient themselves, but they are just interested in optimizing their health.
Oh, so they're like healthy people who want to get healthier.
Yeah, or optimize their training, or optimize their diet.
Ah, yeah, like sports people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we can use the same methods, because
yeah.
they learn different things from you, from learning how other people track different things.
Yeah.
That community has been very important for me in my understanding of my own disease, and how I can manage it, and how I also can find ways to optimize my treatment.
Yeah. So, what happened?
So there's been so many steps in this, but in short, it's been sort of enriching my life and my research as well. So I've implemented it. I used the methods and the learnings in my research, and I've also had some scientific articles published in this area.
Yeah, that's right. I actually saw a recent one.
Yes, on self.
Yeah, because I had to think about that, because in that you used an objective
Yes, finger tapping.
measure. Yeah.
So since one of my main Parkinson's symptoms is slowness of movement, and the medication I take help with the speed of finger movement, for instance, but my whole body. But so I've been using finger tapping. So how fast, how many taps I can do in a specific time.
Yeah, it's just like as many taps as possible.
Exactly as fast as possible. So I've
Yeah.
used that as a proxy for medication effect. And then I've tracked myself over the course of a few days, and at 10 or 12 times a day, different times, and then made graphs, and also had noted down my medication timing so I could see them in the same graph. And that has been really helpful for me to find sort of gaps where I'm less mobile. And then been able to shift my medication, tweak it a bit, so I have a more even effect of my medication over the course of a day.
Yeah, that's nice. Oh, but 10 to 12 times a day, that's a lot. I've actually I'm using an app right now. I'm doing some sort of subjective self-tracking at the moment, because I'm seeing a new specialist in a few weeks. And I want to be able to present my symptoms very clearly, but it's like I want to actually do 4 times a day track my subjective symptoms, because it's just that the app that I use wants me to. And I already get annoyed after 2 weeks.
I know. So
Oh.
I was only able to do this for 2 days straight. So it take and that was probably the most important learning from this, that it takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
Even if it's if I chose it myself, and if even if I do it for something that I know myself helps myself, it's very difficult to motivate yourself to keep doing it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't want to track for tracking's sake, you want to track for a purpose, and then and if you feel well enough, you don't want to track unnecessarily. You just want to get on with your life.
Yeah, and what I actually did was, that's also interesting. Like I tracked for 10 days when I used a lesser dosage of a certain medication, and now I want to track 10 days when I use my normal
Yeah.
level of medication. And now I'm less motivated because I'm doing better. So, like when you're sick, you can't really do much anyway.
To improve, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and now I'm like, okay, but I could do like other things, and I don't
Yeah,
want to sit
exactly.
down
Because now,
and own it.
now you're well enough to be able to do other things. Then you don't want to
Yeah.
waste time tracking, right?
Yeah, but it's good to have a control. Like,
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a balance.
yeah. So I guess you also use your research skills
Yes, I
to
do.
do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked about how it often goes wrong, and now, like, what you do is that you have doctor-centric communication with new doctors.
Yeah.
But does it work? Like, do you get the outcomes that you need, or is it still?
I don't really know, do I? Because I don't know what it would be if I didn't do this. But
Like, do they do the researches that you want to get?
no, I usually don't ask them for that because I
Yeah.
don't. So what I do is what I think the effect it has is that it saves time.
Yeah.
It saves time for me and it saves time for them that I don't challenge them if I think they can't take it.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
what we lack, what's missing in that is that there's learning lost.
Yes. Yeah.
Both for them and for me, I think.
Yeah, because if you would like come up with your own theory and they would actually take it seriously and listen, but still they would think like, okay, your theory is maybe a bit right but also a bit wrong, that would be interesting for you as well. Now you maybe leave with this theory still in your head and you don't know what's missing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so do you think, I actually think that there's a limit to how, as a patient, we can make the situation optimal. Like, we can only do so much.
Yeah, I agree.
We need to change the culture, otherwise it's not going to happen.
I agree.
Yeah. So, but you are, yeah, that's a good shift. Like, you are actually working on doing that right now.
I'm trying, yeah. I'm trying to see how I can influence the system and the culture to change, yeah.
Yeah, so not only did you introduce this new word, but you also founded a new organization, right?
Well, yeah, a network, I think we can call
A
it.
network.
It's not a formal organization yet. We'll see where it takes us. But we have a network where we're trying to highlight and show good examples of patients that are improving healthcare in different ways, not always with healthcare's consent or a collaboration, but finding ways to navigate the system. We're trying to do it regardless of diagnosis, because most organizations in Sweden are focused on a specific diagnosis or condition.
Yeah, like the traditional patient organizations. Yeah. So are you mainly trying to influence patients to develop better strategies, or are you also going to try to change the system more widely?
I think we're trying to do both, but what we that's we have support from the government in we have a governmental agency for innovation systems in Sweden, and we have a project now that we have support from them with a large number of project partners, and together we're trying to find a way of collaborating. And among the partners we have traditional patient organizations, but we also have healthcare organizations and companies and also regions and county councils.
So how do you plan to improve healthcare?
So we're trying to show healthcare what how what can happen if you work in different ways. So we try to lead by example. So we're doing collaborative projects with all these partners, and trying to communicate and show people what the benefits of it, basically.
Yeah, it's so cool. Yeah, I actually I don't think that non-Swedish listeners will get so much out of it, because the website is in Swedish, right?
But yeah. my personal blog is mostly in English.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't write so much about this specific project there, but I there are some posts in English that might interest people there.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point in the interview, both Sarah and me were extremely tired. There was, however, one thing left that I wanted to ask her about, and that is the research she did with a team of other people on the different roles spetspatienter, or in English, lead patients, can play. We decided that instead of pushing past our interview limits, I would just read to you about these roles. So that's what I'll do now. So Sarah and her colleagues interviewed a bunch of spetspatienten to figure out which kind of different ways there are to be a spetspatient, and they came up with 12 roles that spetspatienten play, and I will read them to you here. They are: 1. The activist. The activist works for changes in policy and practice related to their health and healthcare needs. 2. The academic. This one stays updated on the latest scientific articles and evidence. 3. The mentor. The mentor shares their knowledge and experiences to teach others. 4. The patient researcher. Patient researcher uses scientific methods to investigate their health issues and or partners with established academic researchers. 5. The self-care expert does what they can to learn about their health and well-being and works to improve it. 6. The healthcare partner creates and manages partnerships with healthcare professionals. 7. The communicator writes and or speaks about their own health experiences in conferences and meetings and or articles, blogs and social media. 8. The innovator. The innovator creates or has ideas about new solutions based on their health and healthcare needs. 9. The hacker. The hacker addresses health issues through the use of technology. 10. The entrepreneur. The entrepreneur builds companies or organizations from their experiences with health and healthcare needs. 11. The tracker. The tracker self-monitors health issues. And 12. The healthcare coordinator. And this person manages and coordinates multiple healthcare contacts for their health issues. So it's quite a lot of them. And I'm really, really curious in which you recognize yourself. Myself, I recognize myself in a lot of these different roles. For example, in this podcast, I am the communicator. I write or speak about my own health experiences. Although I also speak about other people's health experiences, I think I can also say that I'm an activist, I'm an academic, I have been a self-tracker, and sometimes I think I'm a mentor, and I'm definitely also a healthcare coordinator. So let's see, it would be really cool if you guys and gals could, and everyone in between, could share in which roles you recognize yourself. And I will also link a picture of all these different roles on our social media accounts, so that you can look them up again. And the research that Sarah, or the research paper that Sarah and her colleagues wrote about this, hasn't been published yet. So this is really a special preview, so I'm really glad I could offer you this.
Okay, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm so tired.
Yeah, we'll need to rest both you and I now.
Thank you all so much for listening to the second part of our two-piece series on Sarah Rigere. I am so very grateful that I had the chance to interview Sarah, because I am very fond of her ideas, and I think we can learn so much from her. And I hope that you too have gained a lot of knowledge and insight from this conversation. Next episode, we will listen to a very special conversation I had with a person who has a genetic disease, which among others causes kidney problems, but also made her turn deaf later in life. If you wondered if a deaf person can be on a podcast, well, this is certainly possible. There's still a lot of editing to be done though, so it will probably take a while. Stay tuned, it will definitely appear in your podcast feed one day. Also, Elina and I have been working on our plans to improve the podcast. After the next two episodes, we will present them to you. And we can't wait. Thank you so much, Sarah Rigere, for this wonderful interview. This show was produced and edited by me, Tamer Doordijn. Eline Pollaerts assists me in making the show. Josanna Ruitenberg has transcribed the show to make it more accessible to people with a hearing disability. You can find our show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud and so many other platforms. If you'd like to help us out to get more people to listen, you can do that by spreading the word. Tell everyone you know about this podcast. It also helps a lot if you leave your review on Apple Podcasts, which can actually be done in a second just by clicking the number of stars you give us. In Spotify, you can help us rank higher simply by subscribing to the show. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, or visit the website www.ziektepodcast.nl. Thank you so much for listening.